Have you ever played the what if game? You know that one. What if I hadn't taken this job? What if I hadn't moved to Central New York? It's a tempting game. A classic movie is based on it. It's A Wonderful Life. The ultimate what if game. What if I didn't exist? If we were going to play that game with our Unitarian Universalist Association, we could talk about what if the Dedham controversy had not happened. It is a small part, a small tiny bit of our history, but it is pivotal in what has happened in our association and how we are shaped. In Puritan New England, each town was organized around its church. The members of the church were those who had made a confession of their Christian faith, while members of the parish were those who lived in the town and paid the poll tax that supported the church, but had not had a religious experience of conversion in the church. Reflecting this two-tier arrangement, the minister was both the spiritual leader as the church, as well as the teacher of public morals to the townspeople. These were the standing order churches, church and parish in the same institution, with a religious leader and public preacher in the same person. I'm kind of glad that no longer exists. Dedham was not the first of the standing order churches to split, but it sure made the biggest bang. In Dedham, Massachusetts, a controversy about theology became an ecclesiastical, political, and legal battle, one of the first to challenge the standing order system. In 1818, the Dedham Parish invited Alvin Lampson to be its candidate for ministry. A majority of the church members, being Orthodox, meaning Calvinist, rejected Lampson's liberal views. They voted their refusal to have him as their minister. By custom, the church members decided who the minister would be, but in Dedham, the parish, which was more liberal than the church membership, went ahead and called Lampson as the minister. The more conservative church members weren't going to stand for that, so they left. And as church members do, they took the church records, the communion silver, and the financial assets with them. The liberal faction sued the conservative faction to get the resources back and to establish that they were the legitimate leaders of the church. And the liberal minority prevailed. A jury ruled that according to the law, the church was built and run at the parish's expense for the benefit of the whole parish, and the minister worked for the benefit of the whole parish. Therefore, the parish, not the church, owned the assets, and what's more, the parish had the right to call the minister. The decision rocked the standing order churches, many of which had already started to come apart. In some towns, a liberal minority left to establish a new church. In others, an Orthodox minority left to found a congregation of their own. The reverberations went on for decades, with a quarter of Massachusetts' standing order congregational churches becoming Unitarian within the next 20 years. Three of those churches chose not to become either Unitarian or Congregationalist, but Universalist. Now, without this Dedham controversy, we Unitarian Universalists might not exist as we do. Perhaps the warring factions might have found a way to reconcile. But who knows? Because that's the difficulty of the what-if game. You never really know what the answer is. But at least part of the impact of the Dedham controversy is that the liberal side, the Unitarians, won that round. And in that, Unitarianism started to have some legitimacy. We hold on to the name Unitarian with pride these days. But when liberal Christians were given the name Unitarians by Dr., I like this name, Jedediah Morse, it was meant to be a snub. And so the reverberations were felt, and many congregations split, one part declaring itself Unitarian and the other one declaring itself Congregational. Unitarians eventually became UU, and the Congregationalists eventually became United Church of Christ. And in many New England villages, you might still find First Unitarian Universalist and another congregation First United Church of Christ. A clue can be found as to which of those two held on to the original building, because they will be called First Parish, comma, UCC, or First Parish, comma, Unitarian or UU. In Dedham, there is the First Parish, comma, UU, directly across the street from the Allen Congregational Church, formerly known as First Congregational Church of Dedham. I always wonder what Sunday morning was like as everybody was coming into the church. Like, did they talk or did they just give each other the cold shoulder? But what we get out of this is that we are a denomination of liberal leaders. You have only to go through our history, our family stories, and here's some of the names, and I'm not going to list them all, but here's a few. John Quincy Adams, John Adams, Susan B. Anthony, E.E. Cummings, Buckminster Fuller, Kurt Vonnegut, Thomas Jefferson, and you can go on and on. The split in Dedham allowed us as a church to not be tied so tightly to what had been, and instead think about what could be. The American Unitarian Association was founded in 1825, just 4 years after the Dedham ruling. What if that conflict had not happened? Hard to know the answer, but it seems to me that we would not have been so far out front on so many progressive issues. We've had a lot of firsts in our history, or if not first, at least we have led in so many ways on so many social justice issues. These are our family stories, and they are about how we have tried to and often, in fact, change the world. Our family stories are how we have used our prophetic voices. And perhaps it's only because I'm a Unitarian Universalist minister and a UCC minister, I find it interesting that many times we're sort of tied for first with the UCC. We both are at the forefront. We like to claim the first woman ordained by denomination we use, Olympia Brown, in 1863. The UCC claims the first woman ever ordained, Antoinette Brown, in 1852. They were not related. It's a little like splitting the hairs because the Congregationalists ordained congregation by congregation. So Olympia Brown wasn't ordained by a denomination per se. She was ordained by a congregation. But what is important is that Olympia Brown, the Unitarian, actually did get and keep a pulpit. She could support herself as a minister. Antoinette Brown was not able to keep a pulpit. We were leaders in the abolition movement of this country. John Adams, John Quincy Adams, Bronson Alcott, Louisa May Alcott, Samuel May, Theodore Parker, Lydia Maria Child, William Channing, and more. We were on the forefront of LGBTQ activism. While the United Church of Christ ordained the first openly gay man in 1972, Bill Johnson, the UUA was not too far behind when Mark Bellatini was ordained in 1979. The difference? Mark had a long and successful career as a Unitarian minister. He retired recently from his position as senior minister of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Columbus, Ohio. He served as chair of the Hymnbook Resources Commission, which produced the 1993 UUA hymnal, Singing the Living Tradition. Bill Johnson was never able to find a pulpit. Now, granted, our history of working with LGBTQ rights has not always been good. There was a time in the 60s and 70s when an openly gay man like Mark Bellatini would never have been ordained. Certainly, there were gay ministers before Reverend Bellatini, but they were closeted at the time of their ordination, and if they came out at all, it was only to a few select who could protect their secret. But when we got on board, we jumped in with both feet. The General Assembly, our national meeting, began calling the UUA to fight discrimination against homosexuals in 1970, establishing a UUA Office of Gay Concerns in 1974. The General Assembly affirmed services of union for gay and lesbian couples in 1984, and establishes the Welcoming Congregation Program in 1989 to help congregations extend a genuine welcome to gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. And more than 300 congregations have completed that program now. The UCC did not affirm gay marriage until 2005. Being both an authorized minister in the UCC and the UUA, I like that the two denominations work together in our progressive causes. It's like the two sides of my family actually talk. But I have to admit, I'm really proud that my UUA family is just that much more progressive. And I don't know if you know this, but the UUA has an independent publishing house, Beacon Press. Founded in 1854, it is committed to publishing works that are in line with our UUA faith and curiosity. In the present day world, I think that is amazing. In a world filled with fake news, Beacon Press continues to hold forth a progressive voice committed to giving voice to those who might not otherwise have it. And it has not always been easy for them. During the McCarthy era, when other publishers were too frightened to publish the truth about McCarthy, Beacon Press published many books that told the truth. And in response to that, Albert Einstein wrote a letter to Beacon Press, and in it he said, "If we succeed in renewing the spirit of the American Constitution after the confusion of our day, it will be in considerable measure to the credit of the courageous efforts of the Unitarians and of the Beacon Press." It was Beacon Press that published the Pentagon Papers. Beacon Press found a spot on Richard Nixon's enemy list for publishing the complete text of the Pentagon Papers in 1971. The FBI tried to obtain the UUA's bank records, but a legal battle and Nixon's resignations finally took the UUA off the hook. Beacon Press published Notes of a Native Son by James Baldwin, Gandhi's An Autobiography, The Story of My Experiments with Truth, Cornel West's Race Matters, Leslie Feinberg's Transgender Warriors. Beacon Press has helped to shape the public debate by publishing books that others might not have published. Using a prophetic voice is never easy, but we are in good company, and our forebears have taught us well. It is important to remember that. Peter Layden wrote a blog post entitled, "Why Trump's Inauguration is Not the Beginning of an Era, but the End." In it, he posits the world is in the relatively early stages of an almost inevitable transition to what can best be understood as a new 21st century civilization. Relatively early, meaning roughly one-third of the way through, and almost inevitable, meaning it can be derailed if we make some catastrophic political choices. What is happening now in our country is a kind of growing or transition pain, which does not mean it is not real, not painful, and not terrifying to a good number of people, but it does mean that it is not necessarily permanent. Layden points to California, whose economy and politics were paralyzed in the 90s and the 2000s. And in that time, for a while, they ended up with a celebrity governor. And today? Today, California is totally run by a new generation of progressives. Every single statewide office is filled with a progressive Democrat. Supermajorities in both houses. There are no conservative Republican elected officials to really speak of on the California state level right now. The conservative ideology, and by that I think he means the Tea Party, those policies are dead. And so he advises, stay open to the counterintuitive, out-of-the-box interpretations. Too few of us did last year. Be ready to make hard choices when unexpected new options open up quickly. We may all be faced with them soon. Brace for the big changes to come. They are coming. He goes on, most of all, for those who supported President Obama, stay hopeful. I truly believe that the politics and policies that President Obama helped usher in will prevail in the end. In the big picture view of history, the brief Trump presidency will be seen as a difficult but necessary step in the massive transition between one economic period to another. It is possible that we are seeing the end of America as we know it, and that raises some hellacious anxiety. What about all the gains we have made in civil rights for all races of people, and LGBTQ rights, and women's rights, and environmental protection? What if the end of America as we know it means that all those go away? That is scary. But what if the end of America as we know it means the end of a super conservative, exclusionary, xenophobic life? And by that, I don't mean all conservatives. I mean that really right-wing conservative, not the centrist conservatives. So I was going to end the sermon at this point, but then there was yesterday. And the marches. I wore my pink pussy hat at the march in Syracuse. I was proud to do it. Way more people marched in Washington, in the US, in the world, than was being expected. One could whine about the reporting of the inauguration being inaccurate, but no one is whining about the count of the marches being inaccurate. Some were huge. Chicago, 250,000, or New York City, 400,000. One would expect those cities to have huge turnouts. But here are two numbers I really like. 38 people in Unalakleet, Alaska. The wind chill was hovering at minus 40. 2,000 people, at least, in Syracuse, New York. Final numbers, it's hard to guess, but I've seen estimates anywhere from 3.3 to 4.2 million marched on Saturday, both in Washington, D.C., and across America. The largest protest in U.S. history. Around 270 U.S. towns and cities, and another 75 cities around the world outside the U.S., and in those 75 cities, another 250,000 people. And did you hear of any acts of violence related to the marches yesterday? I did not. This was not so much an anti-march as a pro-march. Pro-woman, pro-black, pro-LGBTQ, pro-eminent, pro-immigrant, pro-disabilities, pro-male. Pro-inclusion march. No one is whining about the numbers because a larger vision was given, one in which love wins, respect lives, inclusion is enacted, and beloved community is built. Chris Blizzard, a friend of mine, and as it happens, son-in-law to Sue Wadley and Rick Olenoff, who are members here, wrote, "Today, people came out in dozens of cities around the globe to support women and make it known there are many of us who want a better world for us and for our kids. Dozens in some places, tens of thousands in others, hundreds of thousands in many cities in the U.S. People that have never marched before. Grandparents, kids, parents, queers, gays, white people, black people from many different nations and backgrounds, all to state that we as a people can do better, and we should. They got on airplanes, they got on trains, they drove their cars, they stood and marched and laughed and hugged. Certainly, for the Americans, it was a chance for the people who represent a majority of the voters to stand up and say they are still here, they still matter, and they should be heard. I'm hearing from many of my friends that they feel better today, especially after the dangerous rhetoric on display yesterday. This is a long fight, and it's going to be constant and intense. Organization is the key and will require a continuous dripping of effort. I'm remembering the phrase I've heard from my teacher friends, "What about Monday?" This means that on the weekend we've gotten together, we've figured out a bunch of stuff that needs to happen, but now we need to figure out how to enact it in the classroom. The same is for us. Keep calling, keep organizing, drive accountability, and cut down the lies you can spot. This is going to be a long fight, and it's going to require all of us to participate, but this country is still worth it. So Monday, let's go. I would add, we got this. We got this. Our forebears have taught us well. In a world without end, I know this to be true. Amen.